Hey, this is Steve Perry, author of all kinds of books and not the rock star, and you're listening to the Ritual Misery broadcast. God knows why.
Hello, and welcome to the Ritual Misery Podcast, episode Beta 50 for Friday, the 25th of September, 2015. This is a show where two lifelong friends talk about geek stuff and whatever else comes to mind. I'm tired, I'm Amos, and that's Kent.
Hey, how's it going?
Man, this is my turn this week to have the exceptionally long week with very minimal sleep and... Wow.
Yeah. Oh, I feel you, man.
So, hey, man, it's not just us talking this week. We actually have another guest.
We do, and I'm so excited. This has been a long time coming. We've been talking for probably, I don't know, 6 or 8 months about getting him on, and life tended to happen over the last however many months, and it's finally happening. We finally got him on. So, tonight... we welcome to the show Steve Perry. No, not the lead singer from Journey. We're talking about the author, the New York Times best-selling science fiction and fantasy author.
The one that matters.
Yeah, exactly. He's written many books, including several set in the Star Wars universe, Alien and Predator universes, Conan, some Tom Clancy's Netforce, his own Matador series, among many, many other books. It's our great pleasure to welcome Steve to the show. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
I'm great. Nice to see you. Finally.
Yeah, right.
This is I think Steve was the first person you actually reached out to try to get to guest on the show. And
that's right.
Yeah. Man, it's
yeah, like yeah. I said, long time coming.
Yeah, so the excitement to have Steve on the show has literally been building for months now. So very glad we could finally get you on. So how has your week been, Steve?
Oh, so far so good. I mean, we actually had rain here today, and this is Portland, Oregon, and we usually have a lot of rain, and we haven't had much this year, so it was a relief.
Yeah, I've heard it's been rather dry up there. I used to live in Lakeview, which is down by the California border.
Yeah.
Just shy of Common Sense. It's out there in nowhere. lived there for 9 months, so that's the only Oregon experience I have. But I remember it rained a lot and snowed quite a bit, too.
Yeah. Not that it really rains a lot. It rains constantly in the winter. But it's not so much that you can't go out and walk around and do stuff. And it's just kind of a continuous drizzle. The forecast for Portland in the winter, generally, if you say it's 40 degrees and rainy, you'll probably hit it right 75 or 80% of the time.
Yes. That's about how Germany was when I lived there.
Yeah. It's a good environment to work in. You want to stay inside.
Right.
Well, there you go.
So Amos, you said your week has been busy. What have you been up to?
I've recovered from my jet lag, finally. And
That's good.
I spent a lot of time at work I just spent a lot of time at work, man. It was just one of those weeks where I'd get off work and it'd still be work time. So... yeah, it just sucked. You, on the other hand, you actually had some excitement this last week.
Well, yeah. Last Saturday, I mentioned it last week that I was going to. I went ahead and got promoted in karate. I had my test on Saturday. It lasted like 7 hours or something like that. So now I'm a fourth ku, which in my system of Shotokan, it's a high purple belt. So fourth coup, for those that don't know, that means that I'm four promotions away from my black belt. So that was pretty exciting. Today, one of the most interesting things, though, that happened today was I was letting my dogs go out in the backyard. And when it came time to bring them back in, my boy dog, Simon, was just barking at the grass, just going crazy. And I was like, what is he looking at? It was a tarantula about the size of my hand was walking through my yard. First time I've seen a tarantula in the wild ever. I've lived in New Mexico for a little over 2 years now, and supposedly they're incredibly common, but I have never seen one until today. So, of course, I had to capture it, scare the crap out of my girlfriend. You know, the obligatory things.
We found one on a, we were on a biking/jogging trip around the base there at Dias, and we found one, and it was massive. It was easily as big as my hand, and it was just walking across the street, and we just kind of watched it and let it go, and it just kind of did its little thing, and we went back to jogging.
Yeah.
Like, they're very fragile, crunchless. If you pick one up and drop it, and it hits the ground, it'll break.
Oh, wow. That I did not know.
You have to be careful if you have a tarantula. They're generally, people have them as pets. This is what a writer's mind does, is you do this kind of research. And someone says, if you take a tarantula and hold it out about shoulder level and drop it on the concrete, it'll just go splat. It's like dropping an egg.
Oh, wow. Dear. That's wild.
Wow. The things we learn on this podcast, I tell you.
Yeah, no.
That was awesome. Google Hangouts just burped right there. So
yeah, I noticed that.
All right. So, Kent, you also had accepted delivery of your iPhone 6S.
Oh, I did. That was an exciting thing today, too. I actually happened to be standing on my front porch when the FedEx truck pulled up. I was like, oh, hey, guess what this is?
This is your new phone, three generations from your old one.
Yeah. Yep, I was running an iPhone 5S, and it was showing its age. And got the 6S, got everything going today, and I actually got to use Apple Pay for the first time ever today.
Oh, wow.
I went to McDonald's to get a chocolate shake.
You never go to McDonald's. You made a special trip to try out Apple Pay in the only place in the entirity of Alamogordo that actually has Apple Pay.
Well, Subway has it too.
You should have gone to Subway.
Yeah, you should have gone to Subway.
True. I was in the mood for some ice cream, so a McDonald's shake fit the bill, I guess.
But I was
very impressed with the speed of Apple Pay. Oh my God. I just double tapped the home button on the phone, held it over the little thing by the cash register, and instantly, it was instantly approved, and the receipt was already spitting out of the machine before I even realized that I'd done it. I was like, oh my God. So yeah, way cool.
Yeah.
So are you running iOS 9?
Yes. Yeah.
9 or
9.01? Well, 9.01 now.
Now, for the record, I'm running 9.1. I'm on the beta. So,
really?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. He's a beta tester.
Yeah. I'm all about it.
Yeah, there's a couple of bugs I want them to fix. I'll tell you about.
Like the fact that you can hack into it and get your pictures and your contacts and everything else from the lock screen without any prior information. That's one of the minor ones, right?
Ooh, that's a feature.
In case you lock yourself out.
No, the bug is when you go to clear your browser history, and you also clear all of your saved passwords and all the websites you visited. So if you have to go, you want to go back in there again, you have to re-enter your password. So you better have it written down somewhere.
So it wipes it. Oh, I did not know that. Oh, I'm not clearing my browser history. I'm not trying to remember all those passwords.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I noticed that when they put out, I run a Mac, and so when they run out, they put out Yosemite, which is the next current operating system for the Mac. Mm-hmm. They did the same thing, but there's a workaround on the desktop. You could just go in and manually clear your history. But on the iOS, my iPad, my iPhone, if you just go through at the bottom, it says clear history after you've been browsing. It does. It clears the history, and it clears out all of your cookies and all the saved passwords.
Yeah.
Be careful.
That's a security feature that nobody wanted.
Oh, man.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to retype all those passwords in. I got too many of them.
Yeah. No doubt.
So, wow. I've been, speaking of Apple and OS devices, I've been messing with OS 2, Watch OS 2, that came out on Monday, I think. And I'll give you the 10-second version. My watch is still an extension of my phone. It's just more capable, especially in the absence of my phone. So now if my phone is not on the same Wi-Fi that I'm on, but I've been on that Wi-Fi with my phone and my watch at the same time, the watch can actually update through the Wi-Fi even if the phone's not there.
That's the big key.
Yeah. It's still tethered to the phone. I mean, you still need the phone to do anything, but it's just a little bit more functionality. I can see this being, the the next step into actually having a fully independent watch. Even though that's not what I didn't buy the watch because I wanted it to be independent. I bought the watch because I wanted an extension of my phone, so I'm not carrying my phone around with me all the time or taking it out of my pocket when I'm on the subway and things like that. So, and for that reason, I still love the watch. I'm still using it every day, finding new little different things about it. And it hasn't gotten old to me yet. In the 2 weeks that I've had it, it has not gotten old. So
right on.
The buyer's remorse that some people have mentioned in their reviews has not kicked in. So now, on that same token, I'm going to attempt to upgrade my wife's watch remotely from 11,000 miles away this weekend. So that should be fun.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck with that.
So,
I hope you set aside the day.
Yeah. Well, that's actually what I'm going to tell her to do. I'm going to show her how to upgrade it, and then I'm going to tell her, okay, now do that, and then put it on the charger and go to sleep, and wake up in the morning, and hopefully it'll be done, because it actually takes a considerable amount of time. Yeah. It's not fast. It was worth it, though. I mean, mine took about an hour and a half to fully upgrade. I had one glitch that I had to go and redo it, you know, reattempt it. But it took about an hour and a half total, so it completed right as I was getting ready to walk out the door on my way to work one morning. So, all right. And what about you, Steve? What geeky things of the week have you done?
Oh.
Besides discover that your browser
cache. Earlier this week, I did upgrade my Apple operating system for my Mac. And it always takes longer than they tell you it's going to take. They've broken it up into bits and pieces now, so it's like, oh, look, the line is finished. I've got it all in. No, now you have to wait for it to do this. And so I had to upload my then I did the iOS upgrade. And then the iOS, 2 days later, they came out with the 9.01, so I had to upgrade that. Well, that wasn't so bad. But geek-wise, I mean, I've been a Mac guy for forever, and so I'm fairly comfortable with the process. I just know it's going to take longer than I think it is. Right. You have to set aside the time, and then you worry. Okay, I'm gonna get it all put together, and then we're gonna see what it doesn't do anymore. And of course, some of the software it always comes. Oh, by the way, this piece of software that you love doesn't work anymore, and we've thrown it into a vat somewhere in the back 40 acres, and you have to replace it with something else. And you know, I'm looking at the 2D icons on my screen. I'm going, you know, they really don't look as good as the 3D icons to me. And sometimes they decide they're going to upgrade Safari, and they did. And then there's a little bug that I spoke of earlier. So you just kind of you're very tentative after you do an upload. You want to be careful because you know you're going to hit a button and that piece is gone. that piece of software doesn't work anymore. It's like, oh, okay, fine. So yeah, that's pretty much the limit of my geekdom. And I went to martial arts class. I go to martial arts class usually Thursdays, and I went last night, worked out, got tired. Oh, by the way, congratulations on your promotion.
Oh, thank you.
That's impressive.
Yeah, I've gotten used to the feature changes because I'm always an early adopter. Like as soon as something comes out, I want to be the first guy downloading it, exploring it, and figuring out what's wrong with it. If I actually had a journalism degree, I'd be that guy, you know.
Yeah.
But no, I just like to tinker.
That's the guy I go looking for when I get my new stuff, and I say, oh, wait a minute, I just wiped out all my history and passwords. And so you get online and look, and you go, oh, by the way, in case no one told you, no one did, we've decided to replace this little thing with this new feature. That's not a feature. It's an abomination, and why did you do that? Yeah. It worked fine before. Leave it alone. No. Apple's philosophy has always been, if it's broke, if it ain't broke, break it. And they come up with a new improved version that, well, it's exactly the same as the other one, except we've taken all of the lists and we put them on this side instead of that side. Why?
Yep.
Why? Yep. Because we had to do something to justify the upgrade.
Yeah. Yep.
It's definitely gotten better over the years with the upgrades going free, so it's not like they're trying to sell you something. It's usually just that one killer feature that, hey, this one actually adds something that I can use, but they don't tell you that it takes away two things that you used to use that you now have to find new ways of doing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But when all is said and done, it still works, which means it's better than Windows.
Yes.
Most of the time.
Yeah, I don't.
Most of the time.
I've only ever gotten one blue screen.
I don't argue with people who don't have Macs anymore. We don't go down the Mac PC, the Wintel box. It's like, hey, you do what you want to do. I'm happy where I am. Yeah. You know.
This is the conversation.
I'm not going to try and convert anybody. If you want to work for the Antichrist, go right ahead.
This is the conversation we just had about Kent's girlfriend's phone being Android and him being on Apple stuff. And
whatever ecosystem you're in, you're probably comfortable there. So
yeah, I'm at the point now where I'm not going to try to convince you you're wrong. I just won't stand you trying to convince me that I'm wrong. So, you know, I'll eventually grow up. I'll eventually not be a 16-year-old anymore. And
it's like getting irate at people on Facebook. It just wastes everybody's time. You know, someone's going to post something that's provocative, and that's why they put it there. It's like, I'm going to get all excited about this. Not really. Not a good idea. Just leave it alone. Just, you know, going about your business.
Oh, yeah.
Facebook.
I so hate Facebook.
Like, the crowd.
Everybody
hates Facebook.
I think what happened was, one day I realized that everything that you need to say about any specific subject, if it can't fit within 140 characters on Twitter, I don't care. Like, if you can't give me a valid argument in 140 characters, you're wasting my time. I've got other things, you know, TLDR, right?
Yeah.
So, most of my time browsing Facebook is like, let's see if anybody put new pictures of their kids. Nope, okay, log off.
Well, you can get cartoons on there now. Bloom County's back. And if you remember Bloom County from when it was back, well, you probably don't, back in the 80s, it's back on Facebook, and Berkeley Breathe is just putting it up there for free.
Yep.
And every morning you get up at 5 o'clock, 5 days, 6 days a week, and there's the new strip. It's like, wow, this is so cool.
So these are new strips.
Share it with everybody I know, and then go, you know, that's the highlight of my morning.
Yeah, yeah, they brought Bloom County back.
These are new strips,
like,
and
it's not new.
Repeats.
Yes, all new strips.
Yeah, because when me and Kent read it, you know, back when we were in the Sunday Comics era of our lives, we were actually reading the repeats from years before. Because it had stopped like in the 80s, like he said. And then we were reading it in the early 90s when it was just, you know, like the best of. And then it stopped completely and we just went away. So, yeah, these are all new, like completely new.
All new, all upgraded, all current problems. Today, Opus is running for president and Bill the Cat is going to be running for vice president. And their platform is go back to putting two spaces after the period when you type.
Oh, I love it.
You want ultimate geekdom? Get into a discussion with people about whether you should put one period, one space, or two spaces after your period. If you grew up in the typewriter era, as I did, you automatically did two spaces because it wasn't proportional typing. All the keys are the same size, all of the little impact. And so you had a period, and if you put you typed the next letter, it was right there, and it didn't look like it was the end of the sentence, so you put two.
Mm-hmm.
Come computers and proportional type, that's not the case anymore. You type one and go on. I know people who still type two, and then they go through again and they global search them out.
I type two, and I've gotten to where I don't know if that's something that I've actually insisted on, or if it's because I don't know if it's not just a reaction to the double space becoming an automatic period in space on phones and things like that. But I do it either way. Yeah. So like when I'm if I'm typing, period, space, space, and I move on, or if I'm on the phone, it's just space, space, move on. So in my mind, it's two spaces regardless of what environment I'm in.
Well, when you do manuscripts, when I started writing, I was working on a typewriter. Not only that, it was a manual typewriter. And I eventually upgraded to an electric typewriter, and then I upgraded to an IBM Selectric, which was the acme of typewriters. We thought we had died and gone to heaven and had a ball, and you could change the type from Pika to Elite, and you had a liftoff tape, and it was like, it'll never get any better than that. And then, of course, computers came out, and the first printer I had typed, I don't know, 15 characters an hour or something. It was really slow. It was a daisy wheel. But when you prepare manuscripts, everything used to be typed. It all had to be in Courier. It all had to be, you know, you choose Pika or Elite, and you used to use spacing, and you type it on the page, and it had to leave an inch at the top and the sides and the bottom. There were all these little things that you had to do, none of which you have to do anymore because you can fix it all in your word processing program. You can put, instead of underlining a word to show italics, you can just put the word in italics. And you can global search it out. If you do one of those, if you type two spaces at the end of the period and you don't like that, you global search it out and change it to one. Ooh, yeah. It takes you, 5 seconds.
I think that's one of the things that really gets me is, you know, the current catchphrase for anything that you're writing or publishing really is that content is king. Because they want the whole transition to just type it out, you can fix it later. But then you've got people, you know, all of us, you know, me and Kent are like at the tail end of it, but all of us that remember actually having to format as you typed or you retyped the whole thing.
Yep.
You know, it's such a big transition to where it's still hard for me. I'm sitting there typing, and I'm seeing the little red squigglies and the green squigglies, and I've got to go back and fix it because I can't.
If it's not fixed now. As I go.
Yeah. I wish I could just, you know, freely just type and just, you know, figure it out later, but I can't. I have to format as I go. It's just something that's locked into, at least into our generation and you know, older, but... Yeah, that's so interesting to see just that little transition.
Writing, if you're writing a novel, at least I was, you started on page one, you know, chapter one, and you wrote until you got to the end. And that was it because it all had to be typed. It had to be typed with carbon paper because you had to have two copies, one to keep and one to send off. And you couldn't afford to go to a print shop and copy it because it would cost a fortune. You know, print copies were, you know, a dime or a piece, and you got a 300-page, you know, book. All of a sudden, boom, that's a lot of money. So you had to do it a certain precise way. Once I got to using computers, I was like, well, I have a great fight scene coming up in three chapters or so, but I want to write it now before I forget it. So I can write it. I can stick it over here. Come those three chapters, I just pick it up and plunk it into place. It is much easier now to write and do it like a jigsaw puzzle than it is to have to write from point A to point Z. A lot of people I know who are writing now do that. You know, you write scenes and you just plunk them all together at the end.
Well, I mean, case in point, George R. R. Martin, he's been writing stuff just randomly for years and just throwing it in a big spaghetti pile and spitting it out because it takes manual effort. I mean, I actually had to concentrate on half the crap he writes because you can tell he did not write that sequentially.
George is a good writer, but he's it's one of the things that if you're in science fiction and fantasy for any kind of time, you go to conventions, if you bump into people. The first convention I went to, I bumped into George R. R. Martin. It's 1977, I think, 76 or 77 in Florida. You know, he was already a well-known writer then. You know, when I bumped into it, and he was making monies on weekends holding chess tournaments, because George is a national class chess player. He was a ranked player when he was in college, and so he could put all this stuff together with no problem. You know, if you could play chess at that level, putting your books together however you want to, that's no sweat. If you can't keep up, well, that's too bad. That's your problem.
Yeah. Oh man.
So essentially, what you're saying is it makes perfect sense to him. Screw me. All right, fine. I get it.
Of course. he's done okay by it. You know, it's I mean, you know, how many people, you know, to go to bed every night and pray that George R. R. Martin doesn't die before he finishes the series? I mean,
no doubt. Oh yeah. Man. So Steve, did you always want to be a writer?
Pretty much from the time I was about 16, I'll be honest with you. I had an English class with a woman named Marianne Brown. Marianne was about 26 or 27, you know, 8 or 10 years older than the class. Gorgeous, absolute drop dead gorgeous one. And just married. And I had nothing to impress her with. I was a skinny little pimply faced geek about 5 feet tall with big glasses. And so I thought, well, I'll write a story. And we had an assignment. I wrote a science fiction story. And she was impressed. She liked it. I thought, well, I've died and gone to heaven here. I have an attractive woman who thinks I'm cool, or at least my writing was cool. So from that point on, it was pretty much whenever I got to the point where I was ready to do it, I was going to become a writer. I actually didn't start cranking out stuff and trying to sell it until I was about 30.
Wow.
Okay. Life got in the way. You know, family, we travel, we did stuff.
Sure.
That's like this podcast.
What did you do in the meantime from that high school class?
Oh, I had all kinds. 30. Oh, yeah. I had all kinds of jobs. My wife and I were hippies. I mean, we moved out to California. I worked in an aluminum warehouse selling aluminum extrusions over the phone to aircraft companies. I was a private investigator. I was a licensed practical nurse. I taught kung fu classes for a while. Eventually wound up working as a physician's assistant in Louisiana. I took a test in the lab what they call a PA, which is sort of halfway between doctor, nurse, and technician. And then when my wife got offered a job out in Oregon, we said, sure, we moved out here because it was a good job. She's making good money. And I thought, well, I'll take a shot at writing and see what happens. And as it worked out, it worked out. I was able to start writing and selling enough stuff to justify staying home. And believe me, it's a whole lot easier writing for a living than it is working for a living. I mean, I sit at a desk in front of my computer and I make shit up, and they pay me for that.
That's amazing.
And I'm telling you, that's better than being a rock star because you don't go deaf.
Right.
Although I'm probably going deaf anyway, but that's, you know, it's not because I the music's too loud. So yeah, and it I mean, really, it's just it's so way cool. I get up when I want. I walk down the hall. I sit down in my office. I write. I get up. I go walk the dogs. I come back. I have lunch. Write a little while more. Knock off. You know, it's just like a real sort of like a real job. But and it's been, you know, keeping the wolf away from the door for, you know, 30 years. So I have no complaint.
That is awesome.
So what is your what is your writing process? Like when you come up with something, is it just you just let it go, or do you sit down and try to structure it out?
It really varies. It's different projects. I've had stories that came up because I came up with a title. There's a Johnny Rivers song that I listened to when I was a kid called Seventh Son. And in the verse of the song, there's a line that said, "Heal the sick, raise the dead." I thought that's really a great line. I can use that. So I wrote it down, and then eventually the idea for what would that do? How would the story come out of that sort of popped up in my head, and I just wrote it down and followed it. I keep notes. I used to keep a notebook with me all the time. Now I keep an iPhone with me, and you know, you can either do dictation or you tap notes in. But yeah, I had banks of notebooks where every time an idea come down, you would write it, put it into a file, and then if it sparks something, it'll come back later. Most of my stuff comes from the news or conversations I'm having. When I wanted to, we had a conversation one morning with my wife over breakfast. We'd gone out to eat, and we were talking about violence in movies and television and stuff. And I found myself defending violence because it had a place in the movies. And the more I talked, the deeper I got, the more trouble I was getting into. And from that, I wanted to come up with a hero, a protagonist, who would start a revolution without killing anybody. So The Man Who Never Missed is a story about a martial arts guy who's really good with a little dart gun, and it knocks people out. It basically, the dart hits them and they freeze and they go into tetany and they can't move for 6 months. And so he's kind of doing this guerrilla action and paralyzing these people, and nobody really is going to rat him out because they can't say anything. They're paralyzed. Yeah, he knows the clock is going to run out because when they start to wake up, the first thing they're going to do is say, he did it. And so I thought, well, how can I – well, that idea, that discussion over breakfast with my wife turned into 8 books. One just sort of followed after another. It's like – and it's the question that you ask is, and then what happened? Okay, well, yeah, you got to the end and they're okay. And then what happened? Look, when George Martin came through town a few years ago, when the first book came out in the series, the Fire and Ice series, he went to a bookstore locally. And I was working off and on doing different things, writing. And one of the gigs that I had was to interview and to write reviews for the local newspaper, science fiction, fantasy, and horror. Those were my story. And so I said, well, George Martin's coming to town. He's a big deal in science fiction. Let me go interview him. And he said, sure, well, you'll run a little piece along with the review of his book. And I said, fine. So I went to the bookstore. I bought a copy of his book. I walked over and I had him sign it. And then we started talking. I was interviewing him. And at one point he said to me, I said, so this is the first book. Is it going to be like a trilogy? He said, yes, a trilogy. Maybe 4 books. Maybe. And if I write more than 4 books, I give my fans permission to kill me. Well, we're up to what, 7 books now, and the monsters haven't come over the wall yet. And it's because he's got all this stuff going on, and he starts writing, and he gets lost, and he goes off, and he sings, and he brings some. And it's like, I can't get done. You know, he was getting ready to write the sixth book, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, I have two books that are split in half. That's kind of how writers' minds work sometimes. Stephen King does the same thing. When he wrote The Stand, I read it. I thought, it's a pretty good book, but it's fat. You know, I'm going to criticize Stephen King.
The unabridged version, right? You're talking about the full length.
Yeah, I thought
length.
The book was too long. It was about 900 pages or so, and I thought, this is a really good 600-page book buried here. Mm-hmm. If you just get something to slip. So later on, I heard King's going to go back and re-edit The Stand, and he's going to put out a revised version. I said, great, that's terrific. And he's going to cut it down. No, he added 300 more pages to it because that's what you do. You have all these things that you want to get in there before you run out. And of course, Stephen King can sell his laundry list, and I like his work, and I really think he's a good writer. But when you let a writer be unfettered, they will sometimes go on. I tend to prattle on quite a bit, and if you channel it into something smaller, it sometimes it's better.
I actually read The Stand. It was the first Stephen King book I read was The Stand, the unabridged version that we picked up in the little rack at a grocery store.
Yeah.
And it was like six bucks, and I asked my mom to buy it, and she's like, there's no way you're going to read that big old book. And I was like, I've read like 300 books. You know, I've read half the Dragonlance books in existence. Like, how are you doubting me on this? And the copy that I picked up, I remember it was like 1,100 pages. It was, you know, the trade paperback, and it was like 1,100 pages. It took me about 2.5, almost 3 weeks to read it. I was sick almost the entire time I read that book. Like, I did not get better until I finished that book because I was constantly coughing, and I could have sworn that I had every ailment in existence.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
That book really changed my way on how to accept a book and kind of churn through some of the slower parts because they build up to something later. You know, you said he added pages. He didn't add events. He added background history to all the events that he had already told you about. And I love the books. That book, it was pretty thick. Like, it did have some points that I was just like,
Look at Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time series, the fantasy series that came out. Jordan was my editor when I was writing Conan novels for Tor. That name is not Robert Jordan, it's Jim Rigney. And of course, he's passed away, but he was a good writer. And when he started writing those books, they just, I mean, they're huge. They're 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 pages long. And they were just coming out one right after another. I mean, he was just cranking the stuff out. And people, you either loved him or you hated him. You know, and I picked up the first one and read it, and it didn't do it for me. But George Martin's book, which is about the same length, I go with because I think he speaks to me as a writer in a way that Jim didn't. I would turn in a manuscript, and I kept trying to slip stuff in. But that's what you do when you're a writer. You're trying to see what you can sneak in and get past the editor. And I would throw in some little events. I had one sequence in one of the Conan novels in which about a half a stanza of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland was buried in there. And I had all these characters that were thinly disguised characters from werewolf movies. And Rigney would go through with a red pencil and write, "No, it's scratched." He caught almost all of them. I got a couple past my Star Wars editor, and then I had to go back and tell him about them before he put them in print. But I figured out the trick. The trick is, if you want to sneak something past your editor, it's at the top of the page you put something so egregious in there that they can't pass by. It's like, no, you can't say that. This is all that, and it sucks their attention in. And then down the page, you put something else in that they aren't going to see because they're still thinking about what you wrote at the top of the page. And they'll go a couple pages in before their brain kicks back in. So I had a sequence where Chewbacca does something that's just totally dreadful. You know, and then I wrote down at the bottom, I wanted to use initials for something. And so it was the subterranean hydroponic interstellar transport, whatever. And the initials are SHIT. And my editor missed it. And so he came back, and so I waited until the book came back and copy edited for him. And so I called him up. I said, "I got a present for you." He said, "What?" I said, "You know, page 87, you know, halfway down." And he goes, oh, Lord. Yeah, I gave you that. If I had let that go through, you would have hated me forever. But so that's one of the little games you play when you literary people go back and forth with.
See,
that's great.
I'm the guy that's sitting there thinking, if those are the ones you're telling us about, what are the ones that you hid really good?
Here's the thing about writing for Star Wars. Star Wars fans know everything. So there are some fans out there that know everything that's ever happened in the universe, and they will catch anything. And any of the Easter eggs that I put in there, and I always put something in there for my fans, there are some people who will catch every one of them. They'll go down the list. On page 17, when you said this, is it what you mean? Now, page 94, when you said this, is that what you meant? Yeah. There's a notorious jewel thief in one of the books, Star Wars book, who's basically my name spelled backwards. There are little bits and pieces that I put in. I have a traitor in the book, and the traitor's name is Benedict Quisling. Well, that's Benedict Arnold, and these are famous traitors throughout history. I want to see if anybody's paying attention. Mm-hmm. Well, enough people read Star Wars that someone is paying attention. My books, yeah. One of the aliens books, I had three Marines, and they were named Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And my favorite line from one of the Star Trek, one of the early aliens books was, I had a guy walk into the aliens were in there, and he walks in with his gun, and he mows him down. And he says, "Eat hot plasma death, alien scum." I always wanted to use that line. It's not a line that you can find a lot of places to use. My editor cut it out and put it up on her wall. Eat hot plasma death, alien scum.
That's very awesome. Nice.
You know, talking about the Star Wars books, the first time I ever came across you as an author was Shadows of the Empire.
Oh, yeah.
And I absolutely loved it. It was such a great multimedia campaign that Lucasfilm did in between movies and all that. And I really enjoyed it. I always wondered what it would be like to be given the reins to just kind of play in that universe.
It was way cool.
Because you were a Star Wars fan to start with, right?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, everybody I know is a Star Wars fan. I mean, it's all the geeks I know. You know, all the fanboys. And speaking as the fanboy, we're I watched the first movie when it first came out on a Tuesday afternoon, and it was nobody in the theater but me. So yeah, I go way back with them, and the way I got the job was kind of funny. I had done a novelization for my editor Tom Dupree at Bantam on a movie called The Mask. He called me up and he said, "I got this movie novelization to do, and I don't really have any money, and I need it in a real hurry." And I said, "Wow, that just sounds great. How can I pass that up? No money, and I have to work really hard, really fast." He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, sure," because I had never done a movie. At that point, I'd never done a movie novelization, and I wanted to do one. So I did it, it was the fastest, one of the fastest pieces of writing I'd ever done. It was like 18 days. I wrote the book based on the script, and he loved it. He thought it was great, and it went out and did what it did. But he came back and he said, "I owe you one," and I said, "Yeah, okay, sure. So how about you want to take a shot at writing a Star Wars novel?" I said, "Oh yeah, I could manage to do that. I wouldn't mind writing a Star Wars novel." And so he pitched me to the Star Wars people. They read some of my stuff. And at the same time, I was working with Mike Richardson, who's a publisher of Dark Horse Comics. And it's in Milwaukee, Oregon, which is about 20 miles from here. So I said something we were talking about. I was doing aliens novelizations for him. And he said, I understand you're up for a Star Wars slot. I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm going to talk you up, because I like your stuff, and I think you're better than their writers." I said, "It works for me." So he did. He talked me up. Tom talked me up, and what I wound up with was Shadows of the Empire. And they called and said, "Come on to the ranch." This was back when they were still at the ranch, and we'll have a discussion. And what we did was I went into a room with 15 or 20 other people sitting around a great big table. They showed me the promo they had made, which was cut from bits and pieces of other movies. And they had a couple of characters and a general idea of they wanted to do a story set in a kind of an edgier, darker universe than sort of the Star Wars underground, basically the mafia in the Star Wars universe. Mm-hmm. And I said, "I could do that." And we sat and took notes, and we went around the table because it was a multimedia project. And so the games guy said, "Okay, we need this. the computer games guy said, okay, I want to have a scene with the sky cycles and motorcycles, you know. We got to have that, so I'm taking notes. And the comic book people said, we want to have this character, you know. And so we sort of parsed out through all these different people that we could use. Han Solo was on ice, so we had to come up with a replacement for him who occupied the same space. We went through all these permutations of all this stuff, and I made notes. And then when I got done, everybody was pretty much happy with what they put in. I went home and wrote a big fat outline and sent it back in. And after it was approved, they went through and looked at all the different stuff. That was the basis for everything else that came. We had a book. We had a CD, a music CD. We had toys. We had games. We had computer games. We had comics, T-shirts, everything but the movie. I'll show you. You can see it here. This is my statuette here of the three villains in Shadows of the Empire.
Oh, wow. You've got
the Emperor,
cool.
You've got Darth Vader, you got and this, by the way, this character's name is pronounced Xizor. It's it's X-I-Z-O-R. That wasn't my name. I think Lucy Wilson, the vice president of the publishing section, came up with that. Because I think she had knew somebody who was Portuguese, and that's a Portuguese pronunciation. So,
okay.
And so that's what happened. I sent it back in, and the outline was approved, and then everyone had to use that outline as the basis for whatever product they did. And you had to stick pretty close to it because it was collaborative. You couldn't step on anybody else's toes.
Wow.
Yeah,
that was great fun. It was a bunch of people who were really good. They really wanted this to be really good, and there were a couple of people working for them who knew everything that had ever happened. So if you had any questions about anything in Star Wars, you just call up Leland Chi. He knew. No, it was a great fun. It was a hoot. It really was. It was a hoot.
Right. So what are your thoughts about, like, your book and all of the ones that came in the other than, like, the last year? They're no longer part of the official Star Wars canon ever since Disney.
No, they never were. Nothing was ever canon but the movies. Everything
right?
else,
right?
They said, yeah. Actually, some of the stuff from my book was in the movies. Some of when they did the remake, when Han didn't shoot first. they did the geeks know this. Yeah, we all know this. Yeah. We know who shot first.
Yeah.
when they did that, there's a spaceship flying off. That's one of my ships. There's characters in there that are from Shadows.
Yeah, that was the
semi-canon.
right. So, well, what do you think about like Dash Rendar or even Xizor or well, maybe not Xizor because I think he perished.
I killed him. Yeah, he's dead. Well, theoretically, he's dead.
Right. But Dash Rendar.
No one's ever truly dead.
Kind of wondering about his fate.
About that open ended.
Yeah. So, what are your thoughts on like Episode 7 or any of the other peripheral movies that are going to be coming out? Is there any hope of your character showing up?
I would love to see some of those people show up. I think Shadows would have made a wonderful movie. It was put between Episode 4 and 5. It would have been Episode 4.4, I think, 4.5. It would, but at the time the book came out, the characters were all too old. I mean, you couldn't have, the same characters because of where it fit in the time. I think it would have made a great animated movie. There was a kid down in Argentina, I think it was in Argentina, who did an entire version of Shadows of the Empire using Legos.
Oh,
and
wow.
He sent me a copy of it. It's pretty cool. If you get online and see if you can find it, it's pretty fun.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I'll definitely look for
it. It would have made a great animated movie, and since they've come out with the animated series, there's no reason why they couldn't do a bigger project. I don't know what direction they want to go in. They can go in either direction. You can go, way pre or way after. I think people were talking about Lucasfilm always kept all this stuff secret. You gave it phony names. You didn't want anybody to know what was going on. I tell you what, Disney could send out a copy of the script to everybody in America, and everybody could know everything was going to happen. And it would still be lines around the equator to get in and see it on opening day because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the story is. Nobody cares. Everybody's going.
Yeah,
and that's
true.
Speaking as a geeky Star Wars fan, I don't care what it's about. I'm going. I saw that lightsaber go zhup, zhup with the two little pieces out the side, and we started arguing about that right away.
yeah, you're right. Everybody's still going to go see it.
I thought the most amazing thing about the whole teaser was the fact that within like 12 hours, all those, you know, the Lego version was up. And, you know, all the alternate versions of that teaser trailer were up so quick. Like, I saw those before I saw the actual, you know, video. Yeah. And I just thought that was, that just shows how excited everyone is about this.
Well, they've got the software to do it now. This is the thing that's so fascinating. Is you can take something and spin it. And anybody with a, you know, a few hundred bucks can get a decent enough software program to go in and basically make a movie. And do CGI stuff that nobody could do. I mean, it's like looking at the Beatles when they crossed the road at Abbey Road. You know, they went into a studio and they had four track recorder. They could record four tracks, which was a big deal. I can record 50 on my Mac using GarageBand. And just lay one over another. Look at the podcast. Look at what we're doing now. We're talking to each other on television. We're seeing each other. Through across thousands of miles, and maybe there's like five people watching us on YouTube. We're living here in the future. I say this all the time in science fiction. Isn't it great living here in the future?
Yeah,
because all the stuff that I was when I was a kid, we passed all that long ago. I mean, I had one of the first electronic computers that was sold in this country when I was working at an aluminum company. We used it to calculate weight on plate and bar and stuff because you had to multiply out height times weight times thickness times density, and you know, and they brought this thing out and it was an electronic computer and it would multiply, divide, add and subtract and square roots, and that's all it would do. And it was this big. It was the size of a Samsonite suitcase, and it cost $1,500 in 1967 dollars, which is probably $10,000 now. And it was just, we were astounded because we've been using 100 key punch rings with a handle on it, you know. Wow. And now, you know, my phone, not even the 6, you know, the 5 has more processing power than all the spaceships that ever flew to the moon and back. I mean, it's just, we're living in the future here.
Yeah.
We really are.
I forget who it was, but someone was asked, one of my favorite internet personalities was asked, when would you want to live? If you could live at any time ever, when would you want to live? And they were like, now.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Why wouldn't I want to live now? And then the follow-up question was, okay, well, other than right now, when would you want to live? And he was like, tomorrow.
Like, tomorrow, that's right.
Like, it is so astounding right now where we're at and the stuff that we have and the leaps that have happened in the last 100 years that to choose any other time would just be crazy.
We have problems, you know, but still, in terms of technology, you know, I can remember when there weren't any computers, you know, except Brainiac, you know, or ENIAC, in a 10 gig hard drive. It had to be something that took 20 guys to use a forklift to get on a truck. I said 10 meg, not 10 gig, 10 megabyte hard drive.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of watch all that stuff over the years, like, wow, it's just, you know, we've really come a long way. It's a great place to be a fanboy geek. And, you know, here I am.
Still churning. Still waiting for Star Wars to happen.
Yeah, I want my rocket car, my food pill, too, although I don't think I would eat the food pill. They've got personal planes out there that you could fly around if you're, you know, stupid enough to do it. some of the future didn't come true. When I was first writing science fiction, somebody put up a piece in one of the magazines, and it was scientists from the year, I think, 1936 or 39, predicting what it would be like to live in the 1969, how things would have evolved, and they missed everything. They had hundreds of channels of radio, but no television. They had mooring masts on the top of the mile-high tall buildings for the dirigibles that would be flying around in the late 60s. Pretty much they missed the computer, they missed television, they missed, you know, the whole raft of things that came to pass, because when you start predicting the future, you always miss the X factor. You know, nobody knew what the transistor was going to do. Nobody knew what television was going to do. Like when I was a kid, and dating myself, when I was a kid, we had the first television set on the block. My father was an electrical engineer, and he wanted to play with it. And so he would open it up and take the back and put a mirror around the front, and he'd be watching mirror, and he'd be wiggling with tubes, and they had tubes in them. And you could go to 7-Eleven store when your tube burned out in your television set and buy tubes. You could take your tube, test it, see if it was burned out, buy a new tube, go home, and fix your own television set. Not anymore.
Oh.
You could fix your own car. There were lots of things you could do that had a hands-on. Those things are not that way anymore. I mean, you know, you can rig a car, and I know you just find this amazing, but you can rig a car so that it puts out less emissions when it's tested at the test station than when it's driving down the road. Just ask Volkswagen.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're still doing that.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
jeez. One of the things that I love doing when I'm looking back at old technology and things like that, because, you know, I've done a lot of study, actual study, and I've got a lot of knowledge on the how computers have evolved, and you know how they've taken the big steps, and Moore's law, and all that kind of stuff. What I really, really enjoy is something that's completely foreign to me, as anyone who's ever met me in person knows. Going back to the 20s and 30s, and watching the little black and white films and things like that on what they thought fashion would be like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, because you want to talk about missing. They completely got it wrong. Of course, I mean, if you're a fashion aficionado, you probably say, no, this is just a modification of that. But to the dumb eye of mine, that is completely ridiculous as well. So it's not just technology.
Well, heck, just look at Back to the Future. Predicting 2015.
Exactly. This is the year Back to the Future 2 took place, and where's my skateboard?
Yeah.
You know, where's all this stuff? You can't predict the future unless you have a working crystal ball, because something always goes in a direction that you can extrapolate from what you know, but there's always an X factor that comes in there that says, no, we're not going to go in that way. We're going to create this new thing, and it's going to take everything. I wrote for the Tom Clancy series, NetForce, and these books came out in the late 90s. It started coming out late 90s. And I sat down one day and came up with a device called the Virgil. It's a virtual global interface link. And it was a small device about the size of, say, an iPhone. And it did everything that an iPhone would do. You had global positioning. You could talk. You could see people on it. You could get, you could connect to the internet. All of these things that you could do. Before the iPhone came out, it's like, I created the iPhone. Well, me and 8 million other people. Any science fiction writer worth his salt has got one of those communicators in his bag someplace. It's like the holodeck on the Enterprise. Sure, we've been writing about that stuff for years and years. You get one right once in a while. You know, Arthur C. Clarke predicted Telstar, the satellites, the weather satellite. Sure, but look at all the things you predicted that were wrong. And what they remember is that, well, yeah, I got this right, and not the 99 things that I got wrong. And anytime you start trying to predict the future, it's a mug's game. You can't really do it.
Right. Unless you're
I like Einstein's quote. Einstein's quote is, the one about World War II, World War III, and World War IV. He said, I don't know with which weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones.
right. Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, very, 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 very much that way.
So I heard that you once met Leonard Nimoy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my Nimoy story. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I was working for a guy named Marty Greenberg, who's an anthologist and a book producer. And he called up one day. He had been doing the Clancy books with Steve Pachinik, who was Clancy's partner. And he said, I got a book for you. You know, you might want to write it. It's based on a comic book series that Isaac Asimov and Leonard Nimoy came up with years ago. And they want to do a novelization of it and comics at the same time. And I said, well, I'm kind of busy here. I got stuff to do. And I didn't really want to do it. I had plenty of work, and I was doing okay. He said, well, here's the deal. I'll fly you to Los Angeles, and you can meet with Leonard Nimoy. Really? Okay, I'm there. Because I'm a fanboy. I'm going.
Oh, yeah.
And
It's the small things.
I flew down, of course, in L.A., and if you haven't driven in L.A., you've missed a real treat. It's almost as bad as Portland. you have some place where you have to go 5 miles. And it can take 5 minutes or it can take 5 hours, and you never know which it's going to be because you can't predict the roads. And so I was supposed to meet him at this nice hotel in Beverly Hills or Hollywood. And so I figured, well, it's this many miles, I'll allow this much time. Well, I got there an hour and a half early. So I spent an hour and a half that morning just walking up and down the streets and looking at everything, all the nice, you know, stucco buildings in L.A., because I used to live in L.A. And I walked around, finally going to have breakfast, and the comic book people have come in, and they're there, and I sit there. So here comes Nimoy, and he's wearing black, and he's got a short beard. And he's very tired. He's been up all night because he's been working on a play that's going to be on Broadway. And I knew that he was a writer because he'd written scripts, and he also wrote his biography, his autobiography, including the second one. The first one was called I Am Not Spock. And then years later he wrote another one that said, I Am Spock, which we all knew. And he had a ghostwriter who helped him with it because there's an acknowledgement on the inside cover. And you can always tell when the acknowledgements are being given out by celebrity writers who the ghostwriter is. They usually get the first credit. And so I knew that he was a writer, and we're having this conversation. He's very tired, but he's being very polite. The waiters are coming over, and they're being nice, and he's being very polite. And you love it when somebody that you admire is a real mensch. He's a real polite, easy to get along with. He's not being a total dick because that would really be bad. So he's being nice to everybody, and he's sitting there talking. I said, so did you actually write your own biography, your autobiography? He goes, well, I wrote the first 30,000 words, and then I kind of ran out of steam. I had some other stuff going on, so they brought in a woman to help me. And so I said, oh, and who was that? And I already knew who it was. But I said, oh, who was that? And he goes, and he went blank. He couldn't remember her name because he was tired and he'd been working. And I said, oh, I see where writers stand in the Hollywood pantheon. You can't remember the name of the woman that wrote your book. And he cracked up. He just laughed like a horse. I mean, he was just howling laughing. That's true. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what? I just made Spock laugh. That's as good as my stand-up career is ever going to be. There's nothing I can do better than this. So that was a nice guy. And I wrote the material. I wrote the book, and I sent it to him. And he went over, made notes on it, sent it back. And eventually it came out and was published to very little acclaim. But, when they came out with it, he insisted that my name be on the cover. He could have just said, by Leonard Nimoy. And he said, no, you wrote this book. Your name goes on the front. So it's good. So I get the book, and I look at it. This is really great. And I'm looking at it like, by Steve Perry, based on by Leonard Nimoy, and you turn it over to the back, and there's Leonard Nimoy's picture on the back, and I went, that's not me. Okay, you can have the back cover.
Yeah, nice. At least your name was on the front cover. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's the little things.
The Clancy book. So when I first started writing, my name wasn't on the cover. I was ghostwriting, and then what happened was there was one of those weird lawsuits where a dead writer had been producing new books, and one of his fans said, he didn't write this. He's dead. Somebody else wrote this, and you're committing a fraud. Some retired lawyer down in Florida with nothing better to do decided he was going to take care of it. And so they said, what do you want? I said, I just want you to put the name of the person who wrote the book on the cover. I don't want any money. I just want you to be honest. And they said, okay, we can do that. It didn't cost us anything. And so from that point on, my name went on the cover of the Clancy novels too. But I was kind of like the first couple of them. It's like, well, my name's on the cover. If people love them, then Clancy gets the credit. But if they hate them, Clancy gets that credit too.
Yep.
It's like the ultimate sandbox.
Yeah, I remember it used to bother me because I used to read the some mystery novels by Lawrence Sanders.
And yep, that was years the case.
I was going to say, because years after he passed, books were still coming out. The Archie McNally novels were still coming out. And then eventually they changed because
if you like,
go ahead, Steve.
I'm still here, but I can't hear you.
Okay,
you glitched.
Okay, well, I was just saying I used to go to the paperback racks, and then eventually the McNally novels were now showing a different author's name. It still had Sanders' name across the top, but it would show the other author's name. Yeah. I was like, okay, well, now it makes sense.
Universe of, you can say, based on an idea by, L. Ron Hubbard wrote Books from the Grave for a long time, and I know people who wrote for those. And some of it's okay. The Parker novels, the Spencer novels by Robert Parker. You know, Parker passed away, and he had like two or three different series going, and they just came out with new ones, but they just put the other writer's name. They say Robert B. Parker's by so and so, and so you know you're getting a Spencer novel or whatever. Yeah, that's legit. That's not, I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
So since we're on the subject,
L. Ron Hubbard's just written hundreds of thousands of words from the grave.
since we're on the subject, what do you think about copyright laws in the U.S. being, you know, what is currently 70 years past the life of the author?
It's the life of the author plus 70 years, and I can understand that that's okay because you get to leave something to your kids and grandkids. Past that, no. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the major properties that are floating around, you know, they just decided that Happy Birthday wasn't copyrighted, the song, because they never actually did the copyright properly. So that's kind of common. But, I mean, look at all the stuff that Disney puts out. I mean, the Tarzan movies, Mickey Mouse, these characters have been held in an iron fist forever because they've got the lawyers and the power to do that. And they renew the copyright. People can't really find me. You're not going to go stand up against the mouse. You get swatted. And I don't have a problem with people wanting to earn money from their work. I do have a problem. I get into wonderful intellectual property discussions online sometimes with people who say, "Well, I'm not stealing your book if I send out copies to other people. I'm drawing business for you." I said, "No, every one of those copies cost me a sale. Those people don't go out and buy my books if they can get them for free." And so we go back and forth on that. But I do think that the basic copyright law, it could be less than 70 years. I don't think it needs to be any longer than that. I think at one point it was 35 years, and they've changed it off and on over the years. I think the basic intention of copyright law was to protect the creator for his lifetime or her lifetime. And then maybe enough to get their kids going down the road, pay for the grandkids to go to school, and after that it goes into public domain, and that's fine. I think it should go into public domain past the point.
Cool.
Okay, so another question for you. My girlfriend, huge Resident Evil fan, and she's been reading the Resident Evil novels for years. And when I was going through and over the last week or so, I was doing some, a little bit of research on you and stuff. And I pulled up your Wikipedia page and I saw, as I think it was listed as family or something like that, S.D. Perry. It's like, that name sounds familiar. Yeah. So I clicked on it. Your daughter, yeah. Stephanie,
yep,
wrote all these books that my girlfriend has been reading. She was just, like, not very long ago, was raving about these books. And I was like, "Oh my God, what a small world! I'm about to talk to her dad on Friday." So I was curious. Yeah. I was curious. What is it like to write a book with your daughter?
Well, it started out when she graduated from high school. We were all set to send her to college. She didn't want to go. She wanted to go out and live in the real world. Okay, fine, go live in the real world. So she went out for a couple of years and lived in the real world. Had a job working as a waitress and came home and said, "You know, this is not all it's cracked up to be. I'd like to go to college now." And we said, "No, we spent that money. It's gone. You know, we bought a new car. You know, too bad." But I said, "I'll make you a deal." Because I knew she could write. She wrote her first short story when she was 16, and it was brilliant. It was a short, which is really hard to pull off. It was perfectly written. There was nothing wrong with it. It was great. It was very evocative. And she said, "What should I do with this to fix it?" I said, "You don't do anything to fix it. You send it off to a magazine." And she did. And she sent it off to Dean and Chris Rush's hardback magazine, Pulp House. They bought it. First story, first submission, first sale. I could have strangled her because it took me forever to make a sale. I had hundreds of rejections in my house before I ever, you know, got a sale. But she was a good writer. So I said, "I'll make you a deal. You want to go to college? I'll get a book. I'll get a novelization to do from somebody, and because I could do that at that point. And you write it, and you can have the money. I'll help you get started." So I talked to Mike Richardson at Dark Horse, and we want to do some more Aliens books. And so I said, "Okay, fine. It's okay. My daughter writes them with me. So I don't care, you know, as long as they're good." I said, "Well, of course they'll be good." So what I did was we were using the graphic novels, the comics, as a basis. So that was easy. You had the comic. You knew what the story was going to be. You knew the characters were. So I gave them to her. She wrote the draft. I went through and rewrote the draft and cleaned it up and sent it off, and they bought it. So with junior, senior authors, usually what happens is one of them does most of the work and one of them does most of the editing. Sometimes you go back with writers of equal stature, you tend to go back and forth. It depends on the collaboration. With Danielle's case, she was so good, she probably wrote 85% of the first book, and she wrote 95% of the second book, and by the third book, she didn't need me at all. So I said, go, and she did. She's probably written, I don't know, 30 books at this point, including Resident Evil novels, a bunch of books in the Aliens universe, and Star Trek, oddball novelizations. I think she did a Xena Warrior Princess, and she named the... She didn't like the way that they edited it, so she changed the name on the cover. She gave them their dog's name. So, I think the book is by Stella Howard, which is the name of the two dogs she had at the time. So, I mean, she has her own career, and so we don't really – I mean, she likes horror. She's a big horror fan. And her own books, the ones that she's written on her own, the most notable, I think, is The Summer Man. It's just a straight horror novel, and I can't tell her anything about that. She knows as much. She's as good as she needs to be. And was way better than I was at her age. So, yeah, I've collaborated with several people over the years, and it's always an interesting process, but it's always different. I'm working on a book right now with Daniel Keith Moran, who's a pretty well-known science fiction writer who's really geek. He's a computer guy. That's all. He makes his money programming and running computer stuff, and he writes science fiction fantasy when he thinks about it. So he takes 10 or 15 years to do a new book, and everybody's waiting. So he called up one day. We were talking about it. He said, I got an idea for a book. You want to write a book about this? And because it has a lot of music in it. I have musicians that don't really know much about music. I said, yeah, sure. So we're doing it on Google Docs. You know, he writes a piece. I write a piece. I go read what he wrote. And on Google Docs, it's really cool because when you're typing, the other guy can see what you're typing in real time.
We use Google Docs for our show notes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even when he makes the mistake and backs up to retype it, you can see that. Like, that's just so cool in real time. You can watch somebody else work. You're a slow typist, Dan. Yeah. Well. So. those days when I first started writing, you know, when I had a computer, and the guy that I wrote with lives in Los Angeles, he had a computer. If we wanted to write to each other, the only thing we could get on something like CompuServe. Or AOL or someplace, and we can send documents back and forth at like 300 baud, which is not as fast as I can type. I could literally out-type the computer going across. And if we were in a real hurry, I would just take a disk and overnight it to him, 5.5-inch floppy disk, by the way, right. And he'd plug it into his computer, and then we would have it. Those days, you know, we're way past that now. And it all had to be an ASCII. We couldn't even format the document. I'd have to send him an ASCII file. He'd have to take the ASCII file and go through and format it and actually put in, you know, all of the yeah. It's like stone knives and chisels. I mean, these kids today, they don't know how good they have it. You know how easy things are. Back right. In my day, we had to walk 10 miles to school every day and home, uphill both ways, in the snow, being chased by Indians and dinosaurs.
Yeah.
in the blistering sun. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so this is one of the small things that I keep mentioning, but the small thing of spell check, you know? These kids, like, they intentionally spell shit wrong. Yeah. And
yeah. Back when beyond spell check, you got autocorrect.
Yeah, oh, that makes you even more fun.
Yeah,
some demented genius, you know, you program an autocorrect. Really, you got that word out of what I wrote? You got to be kidding me.
Yep. I remember one time I typed in autocorrect.
The first thing I do is turn off autocorrect on everything I've got. So.
I remember one time I typed in autocorrect because I was making a comment about autocorrect, and it autocorrected to automobile. And I was like, "That's case in point, right there. Case in point."
I can understand shorthand. I'm not a good texter. You know, when I get on a phone, I have to very carefully punch each key. And you know, my kids and my grandkids can take a telephone, you know, a cell phone, and they're moving their thumb so fast that they're typing 50 or 60 words a minute. It's just amazing to watch. Mm. I can understand shorthand there because it makes a lot of sense. See you later. CULATR. Yeah, that's fine. But if you're writing in a public forum in language that's supposed to be the common American English, I'm not the grammar Nazi I used to be. I used to get all bent out of shape about shall and will and what the real meaning and hopefully when you mean what you really mean is I hope.
Yeah.
And I got a list and list of these things. I just let all that go. It's that battle's lost. You know, you can't win that. People can't difference. You know, they don't know the difference between there and there. Spelled right. Three different ways.
Yeah,
and autocorrect won't help. You know, and spell right. check won't help because it's a real word.
Yeah, Kent can actually testify.
Grammar check is worse.
Yeah, Kent can actually testify that there are times when I won't reply to a text if it's not formatted at least 95% in actual English. So, like the shorthand, unless I know it's a situation where you're in a hurry or in a meeting or something like that, where you got to get your phone down as quick as possible.
Yeah,
you send me some crazy junk, especially my kids. They send me crazy junk, and I'm just like, they're like, "Did you get my text?" I'm like, yeah,
no,
but you didn't reply.
Something.
Yeah, you didn't reply. I didn't understand it. I don't know what language you're typing in. You know, so but in return, all of my texts and they're the same premise. Unless I'm in a huge hurry, all of my texts are, you know, I've got punctuation and, you know, even when I voice dictate to my watch, I'm like, "How are you doing?" ? You know.
Yes. Yes.
So maybe I'm a little too traditional.
It depends on when you were raised. You know, what you learned coming up. I learned to touch type on a typewriter back in the days when we had manual typewriters. And the way you learned was they put you in a room with a typewriter and had no letters on the keys. You learned A-A-A-A-S-S-S. You know, for a while, I actually could touch type, you know, pretty quick. I could do 80, 90 words a minute on an electric typewriter. Uh-huh. I could go as fast as I want on a computer, but one of the things that's interesting is that I have this wonderful keyboard. You can't see it. It's a Kinesis. It has scooped out keys because for a while I was having some problem with my fingers. So this is very comfortable. All the homeroom keys are under your thumbs and so forth. And I thought about doing the Dvorak keyboard. I tried to learn it, but it's so slow I couldn't make myself slow down enough to learn it. But it makes things a lot easier. But I have a program installed in my computer that makes the sound of the typewriter key whenever I push one of these buttons. Because I like the feedback. When I was working on a typewriter, I could sometimes tell if I'd mistyped a letter by the way it sounded.
Wow.
And,
So now I have this that goes on my keyboard. We had a parakeet once that I kept in my office, keep the cat from eating. And the parakeet would listen to me type all day. And the parakeet could make typing sounds. It would go.
My wife and I had a friend when we were in Hawaii who he was a computer guy and he had his computer set up just the way he wanted and he had his little cubicle set up just the way he wanted everything else. So what he would do, he would set the default keyboard on his computer to the Dvorak keyboard. Of course, nobody knew how to type Dvorak. They all, you know, it was QWERTY or nothing. And then he would additionally take the keys and mix them all up. Just randomly. So you sit down and even the key that you think you're typing isn't, you know, they're like, "Oh, I can still touch type. I can get it." And they'd go and try to touch type it on a, you know, QWERTY, but it was set to Dvorak. Yeah. And he, nobody messed with his computer. Like his computer was by itself and he'd be like, "Yeah, blah, blah, blah." And then he'd go over to like a coworker's computer and just switch automatically to QWERTY and be ready to go and then go back to his own computer. Like, where is your brain at, Tom?
My son learned how to do Dvorak typing. I started training because this keyboard has a switch. You hit a button, it'll go Dvorak. And it had the first one I had the Dvorak keys underneath the regular QWERTY keys. And I thought, you really do move a lot less when you use Dvorak. The problem for me is that it takes about 40 or 50 hours to get proficient.
Yep.
And I'd be trying to write something, and I would be going so slow. My brain was down the road and around the corner. My fingers were still back here, and I couldn't do it. If I had, you know, if I didn't have to do any writing for anything other than just to sit and learn the system, I could spend 40 or 50 hours doing it. And you know, but as it is, I'm not having problems with my fingers. The keyboard cured any ills that I was having with, you know, with repetitive strain injury, and I can type this 60 words a minute all day if I have to. So
it's awesome. Yeah. It's awesome. So before we continue, we noticed a little glitch in our talk with you. Kent ran over a couple of our Reddit questions with his own questions. So before we go any further, I want to make sure we give credit where it's due. DPX106 and ConBro8 both asked a couple questions that led into some of Kent's questions, specifically about Disney and Star Wars and about Dash Render making his way into new lore. So I want to make sure that they're giving their proper shout-outs for those questions. So DPX106 and ConBro8, we appreciate it.
I can give you a codicil on the Dash Rendar question. Dash in the movie, in the book, Dash flies into what looks like the heart of the star, you know, explosion, and disappears. And he picks up in the video game coming through on the other side. So everybody knew that he survived that explosion, if they played the video game back in the day. And so later on, when I was working with Dark Horse, I pitched them a 5-issue miniseries, which was the sequel to Shadows of the Empire. And they went for it. And Lucasfilm went for it. And so I actually wrote those books, and you see in there Dash Rendar comes back to life. He's, you know, he has a role. One of the main characters in the miniseries was a human replica droid, a character called Guri. And she was basically a you know, kind of a bodybuilding sex slave and you know, a tough girl. And so I followed her through the process, and then at the very end, you get to see she meets up with Dash. And so, yeah, those doors are all open. And same thing with Shizor. Shizor had a niece who was in Black Sun, and so she came back and was kind of running the organization. There were, you know, in science fiction and fantasy, nobody ever really dies unless you want them to really be dead. Right. You know, Spock died, and they brought him back. So it's like, well, you just the most remote bit of ambiguity that you want to put in there will give you an opening later if you want to bring somebody back. So I'd love to see all that stuff go forward, because I think they were really interesting characters.
Yep, I agree. That was Shadows of the Empire, that whole thing was just, it was awesome. I did want to say, ConBro8, in addition to asking questions, he had a couple comments for you. Okay. He said, hello, Steve. I just wanted to thank you for writing my favorite Star Wars book of all time, Shadows of the Empire. It was the first adult novel I ever read and made me fall in love with reading. Thank you.
I appreciate that. I got a lot of fan mail on that book, and also made a lot of money on the book because I got a royalty, which wasn't always the case with Lucasfilm, and I got a very small royalty, but it sold so many books that actually made me some money. And probably the first year or so after the book came out, I must have gotten somewhere north of 1,000 letters, plus a bunch of emails. Probably 90% really loved it. The other 10% hated it, and they hated everything I'd ever done, and they would hate everything I'd ever do from this point forward. And you can't please everybody. You realize very quickly there's some fanboys out there that they know what color the the lint is in Darth Vader's pocket, and if you don't get it right, they will tell you. So, you know, it's like an episode of The Simpsons, you know. You have the ultimate fanboys are always in the audience, and you really can't write for that level of dedication because everybody else will not know what you're talking about.
Right,
and right, right.
So it's kind of fun to do that, but I got a lot of mail, and a lot of what I was getting was from 10-year-old kids. And I'm thinking, you know, I didn't really write this book for 10-year-old kids, but there are some really bright and advanced 10-year-old kids out there. When I was 10, I was reading Hemingway. And the reason why is because it was in my mother's book rack, and I read everything I could get my hands on. And she didn't know that she didn't read them. They were just there because they looked nice. My parents had this wonderful book rack. They belonged to the Book of the Month Club, and they would come in and they'd put them in the rack. And they never looked at them. My mother read magazines, and my father read technical journals. He was an engineer. So I would go get these books out, and I'm reading Ernest Hemingway. I'm 10 years old, and Lloyd C. Douglas, all these guys that are adult writers. And so I don't try and dumb anything down when I write it. I had 10-year-old kids, but I also had people that were adults who were saying, this is a real book. This is not just, you know, rockets and ray guns and robots and stuff. There's some real stuff going on here. Well, that's the point, isn't it? When Michael Reeves and I wrote a couple of books that were basically MASH in Star Wars. They were at a medical surgical unit in the field, and we had characters. And we just got off. They let us talk about anything we wanted to because they were almost all new characters, only a few characters that were already in the canon that we had to use. And so we got off and we started talking about the three different kinds of slavery there were in the Star Wars universe, you know, the real slaves, you know, and then there's the droids who are essentially all intelligent beings and slaves. And we had a fine time and nobody said anything about it. They let it go. So if you're careful and if you're clever, you can put stuff in there that appeals to people across the spectrum. Awesome. I know a lot of adults read the Harry Potter books. The first time I saw one way back in the day, well, I went to a book signing and they wanted us to do a reading for children and they handed us this Harry Potter book and we actually read it out loud for an hour, the other writer and I. They're like, this is pretty interesting stuff. And when is the last time that people went out to a bookstore at midnight and stood in line and waited to buy a book, Harry Potter?
Yep.
Whatever you think about her writing, whatever you think about her level of storytelling, she reached out and grabbed an audience and pulled them in. All of those kids that read those books, you know, maybe didn't go on to become readers, but a bunch of them did. A bunch of them went off to read other stuff. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, you watch Star Wars. That doesn't mean Star Trek. That doesn't mean you're going to be a hardcore science fiction fan necessarily. But it also doesn't mean that you won't. There are a lot of people who start out drinking cheap sweet wine and wind up with the really nice dry stuff that's expensive down the line. That's how you get from one point to another.
Yeah, right. I'm actually not much of a science fiction fan myself, but I'm a huge Star Wars fanboy. So, yeah. You know, I'm much more the fantasy and the horror. You know, we had Margaret Weiss on a couple weeks ago, and Stephen King is another of my favorites. Those two authors are probably my favorite of all time, and completely different genres.
Well, but, and this is the thing. Science fiction is just a subset of fantasy. It's just fantasy with science, where the science has to be, you know, the forefront of the story. If in the old definition of science fiction that I always liked was if you take all of the science out of it, the story doesn't work anymore. You can have rockets and ray guns and spaceships and all that stuff, and if you take all that out and the story still works fine, then it's not a science fiction story. That's why Star Wars is not science fiction. It's fantasy. It's actually samurai movies. I mean, if you watch a good samurai movie, then watch Star Wars. You know, there's no question where they got all that stuff from.
Yep.
But you can take all of that out. You can take the rockets and the robots and all that stuff, and the Star Wars will work just fine as a Western, as a comedy. I mean, all those beats are still there. A lot of what people say, point at, and they go, this science fiction, not really, it's not science fiction, it's fantasy. And there's nothing wrong with that. I like fantasy. Fantasy is not necessarily just going to be about orcs and dragons and, you know, and magic sex. I like urban fantasy, where a lot of stuff takes place in the here and now on Earth. And you look up and there's these weird things around the edges.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's. I don't want to curse the conversation, but that's Heroes. You know, that's that whole series. And you know, until it went to crap. I don't know about the reboot, but you know, that was one of the things about Heroes that was so widely appealing. Is all the characters were identifiable, but there's still something there, that extra edge that just took it beyond what you normally experience in life. And you know, things like that. Yeah. It works, and it's great.
Yeah, so. And you know, every once in a while, they'll try to give you some sort of pseudoscience explanation. Eh, it's like Superman. I mean, Superman is Superman. If you start getting into the details of all the stuff and why it works and doesn't work, it's not. I mean, it's like it's not going to work. He comes from another planet. He has powers and abilities. Let it go. All the rest of it is, you know, my whole job. I used to do a whole routine about Superman about. I think I had a stand-up comedy routine that I used to do at science fiction conventions. Look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman. Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond me. And I can do the whole thing. And then I would go off this whole riff about the ideal job to have would be working as an obstetrician, making glasses. Because in Metropolis, everybody needs glasses because they can't tell the difference between a bird, a plane, and Superman. And so I'd be grinding glasses all day and putting them out there, and you'd never have a slack day. You'd be a sinecure. You'd be always working because they're all blind. And The old Superman series, I grew up, the first television program I ever saw was the original Adventures of Superman in black and white with George Reeves. Came on in the 1950s. We had just gotten a TV set. We clicked it on, and it's Superman. And I watched them all, and I have them all on DVDs now. And you can go through and watch. There's one episode in particular where Clark Kent is pretending to be sick, and he's in bed, and he takes off his glasses. And he's lying in bed with his glasses off, and Jimmy is there, and Lois is there, and they still don't recognize him as Superman. And I'm going, you. But, of course, you know, it's superpower. I mean, you can get into all that kind of stuff, and you can really hoot with that. Just some of these things you just can't look at too closely. I mean, when they showed the new lightsaber shows up online, and it's got a cross piece. And my first reaction is, because I've done some study on lightsabers, having built one, I actually built Luke's lightsaber in Shadows. You know, we did it. Well, when those little cross pieces are not going to do any good, because that lightsaber comes down, if it doesn't hit the other lightsaber, if it hits the little metal piece, it's just going to shear right through there and cut your arm off. So what's the point? Well, it's made out of such and such. You know, there are some materials that a lightsaber won't cut. And I said, and I'm sure they better explain that when at some point, because otherwise every science fiction geek out there fan is going to go, no, no, it doesn't work that way.
I don't know.
All of the fans can get quiet. My first death threat ever was from a Star Wars fan.
Okay, wait.
When I was on AOL, and I got the job, and someone wrote in, right, oh, bad news, folks, Steve Perry is going to be writing Shadows of the Empire. I'm like, wow, I'm crucified, and I haven't even written anything yet. They condemned me. So after the book came out, and I started getting some notes from people, and the guy wrote back to me, said something about what a crappy writer I was, and he goes, yeah. So anyway, the conversation progressed, and he was not happy with what I had done, and so he said, somebody should kill you. And I went, wow. And so I called up a buddy of mine, K.W. Jeter, who is a writer of some note. If you want to know, he's the guy who basically came up, I think, with the term cyberpunk. Jeter is a really good writer, and he'd written these weird stuff. And he wrote a couple of Star Wars books, too. And so I called him. I said, K.W., I just got a death threat. He goes, really? Your first one? Wow.
I'm still stuck on the fact that you're like yeah, when I got my first death, I'm like, you've had multiples, like, this is not normal.
Exactly.
Life.
That's my first reaction. Really? Oh, well, okay, fine. You're not really going to come to your house and kill you. He's just a Star Wars fan. They just like to blow off steam. Okay, fine. Tell us a job.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Right. No.
Oh, geez.
Oh, boy.
That is amazing. Okay. I can't let it go. I've got to mention, we had a nice little conversation about Leonard Nimoy, and I have to ask you, a lot of people, I always thought he had a very stern image, that he wasn't a very jovial person, because it's only what you see. Until one day when I saw the Bruno Mars video for the Lazy Song, and I saw alternate version. And that is still to this day one of my favorite videos of all time. It's just so darkly humorous, and I was hoping you'd seen it, so I'm glad that you have.
Oh yeah. Some of these guys, I mean, they have an image. You know, the Shatner was supposed to be just such a total dick, and part of it was because he truly didn't understand what the problem was when people didn't like him, and when it was finally explained to him, he's like, oh. He was so much in his own head, he was not paying attention to people around him. And I've seen him do a couple of funny riffs where he's really funny. And it's because he recognized, he was working on the Star Wars or a Star Trek show, and this happened, that happened. Yeah, people didn't like him because he was, I mean, there's actually a fairly, did you see Galaxy Quest? You must have seen Galaxy Quest. Pretty much nail that kind of stuff down pretty solidly, you know. It's every once in a while you hear these things and you see these things and you go, yeah, that's probably what's going on behind the scenes. But most of the people I've met, Nimoy was a sweetheart. He really was. Given the fact that he was completely exhausted and tired, he could have been really snappish. The way I judge somebody in that kind of situation is, how do you treat the waiters? How do you treat the waiters and the people that you don't have to be nice to? And if you're nice to those people, it makes a big difference. There's a whole story and I, it's too long to tell, but I wrote animation for daytime TV for a while. I wrote a lot of episodes of a lot of series, including Batman and Gargoyles and these things. And I went to lunch once with a guy who was an animation bigwig, and he was obnoxious to the waitress. And during the course of the meal, she put him down so well, so beautifully, that the rest of us that were there were all on the floor rolling around looking for our scrotums, which had fallen off. We were laughing so hard. It was just hilarious. If you sit at a restaurant and you're nice to the waiter and waitress, it doesn't cost you anything. If you're obnoxious, it doesn't, you know, it just proves something that, like, why do you, I mean, this is a waiter. You don't have to piss on him. He's making minimum wage plus tips, you know? So yeah, I really liked Nimoy for that reason. I thought he was just as sweet and polite a guy as he could possibly be.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's always good to hear. Because you look at, you know, these iconic figures, these celebrities, and you're like, man, I really wish, or I really hope that he's a nice guy. And yeah, when it turns out they are, it's like, oh man, that's awesome. You know, that's great.
See, I see it also the other way around too. Because when I was a teenager, I idolized Axl Rose. Like, I thought he was just the rebel, yeah, the you know, the cause of all the angst, or you know, the cause for, you know, all my inner angst and an outlet and everything else. And he's just a dick. Like, by all accounts, it's universally accepted yeah, that he's a self-absorbed asshole.
The ones that the people that I've met, Stephen King is a really nice guy, and he doesn't have to be. He makes enough money for his book publisher that he could be a total dick and they put up with it. But he really is a nice guy. And the first time I met King was at a science fiction convention in Seattle. It was a Norwest Con in Seattle, right after Carrie, the book came out, before any of the movie stuff he had done, before anybody knew who he was. He was there at a panel, in a group signing. There was a bunch of writers in there, and they were signing autographs. And I was doing a stand-up routine at the Masquerade, and so I had gotten dressed up as a redneck alien, and so I was wearing overalls, no shirt, no shoes, and carrying a blaster rifle. And I was on my way to go do this little stand-up gig, and I'm running through this room full of writers, people that, you know, that I sort of vaguely knew. And there's Stephen King, and he's got a pencil, you know, and he's pushing on the table, and he's looking around. Nobody there. Nobody knows who he is. And I skidded to a stop. I said, "Stephen King." He said, "Yeah." Wow, well, I read your book, and I really liked it. He said, "Oh, well, thank you." And then, you know, I've got a new book, you know, I'm just making this. We talked for a couple of minutes, and I zipped off. Okay. Well, in retrospect, I didn't really want him to remember me, because I was wearing overalls and no shirt and shoes and carrying around and looked like a hillbilly. And I, you know, those are my roots. So fast forward two or three years, and I went to the World Fantasy Convention in Oakland, and I had my daughter with me. And she was a stone Stephen King fan. She loved everything he wrote. She wanted to be Stephen King when she grew up. So we're in the lobby.
No heartache on your part, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. No. so we're in the lobby, and here comes Stephen King across the lobby, and he's got an entourage now. Now everybody knows who he is. Now the movies have come out. He's been in the movies. He's written all these things, and he's walking across the thing. And I'm, you know, he doesn't know me from a hole in the wall. Well, I walked across him, and I said, "This is Stephen King." She goes, "Really?" And he walks across, and he looks at me, and he says, "Hey, Steve, the price of fame." And he walks off. And my daughter just went through the floor. "You know Stephen King?" "Not really, no, but he obviously remembered me. That's too bad, because I don't want to be remembered for that costume."
Man.
If I ran into him now, he wouldn't know me from a hole in the wall. But that's, you know, every once in a while you bump into, because I go to these things, I used to go to a lot of conventions, so I would bump into all of the people that everybody knew. So I've got stories where I bumped into them, like, "Well, this guy did that, and this guy did this, you know, and Harlan Ellison's over here." And it's kind of fun. You're out, sort of out on the periphery. I mean, I have a right to be there. I'm a writer, and I'm, you know, make money at it. But no, I'm just sort of just minor little talent over in the corner. And these are all the big names and the big wigs. And so I just kind of watch. You know, it's kind of cool. It's kind of fun.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Speaking of conventions awesome. And things, If people wanted to get more in touch with you and find out where you're going to be, and I mean, what big plans do you have coming up?
Oh, you know, I the only public thing I have going on. It probably, I think it's the weekend of the 20th November. There's a local convention called Oricon, and I usually go every year, and I do panels, and I do readings, and I do signings with all the other writers who show up there. I've been going that one for, I don't know, 35 or 40 years, however long it's been there. I used to go to a lot of big conventions and a lot of stuff, and I just don't go as much anymore because I don't have to work as hard as I used to. My wife is retired, and I spend more time with her and the dogs and, you know, kids and grandkids, and then I will, you know, learn to play the ukulele, and I've got other things to do. So now I have no deadlines for the stuff that I write, and I'm not trying to sell anything, so I'm not going to conventions and hustling editors and trying to get work. Used to do that, and it worked pretty well. But it's so, yeah, pretty much I'm much more down to home. I'm basically an introvert. Most writers I know are introverts. They'd rather be at home. You go out and you have a public persona that you put on when you go into the things, and as close as you can keep it to who you really are, the easier it is to do. But I come home tired. I know people who go out and they will party all night long, and they will be the life of the party, and they come home with more energy than when they left. Those are extroverts. And you don't see a lot of those in the writing field, but there are some. Gene Al used to be one. Steve Barnes, the writer Steve Barnes, if you're a martial arts guy, you've read his martial arts stuff. He goes out and gets into the life of things, and he's just blowing and going, and he comes away, and he's got energy coming out of his pores. It's like, I'm tired. I got to go lie down now. I had a conversation with somebody for 10 minutes. We're done.
Yeah, right.
That's awesome.
Well, Steve, I tell you what, I have so enjoyed the last hour and a half listening to your stories. I would absolutely love it if you would join us again for a future episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll come back. You know, I'm at home. It's easy here.
Yeah. But that being said, we are going a bit long on the show, so I think we're about to wrap it up.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And sure. I am extending you the open invite. You are welcome back. Anytime. We do the show about the same time every week, and we try to stick that schedule as much as possible. So anytime you want to come back, shoot me an email, and we will do this again. This has been awesome.
I will. It was fun. It's always fun.
That being said, we do have one minor bit of business to take care of. And Steve, do you know anything about TED Talks?
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay. We had a writer or a listener write in and ask us real quick to explain TED Talks, because we like to feature them every week on the show, but it's been quite a while since we've actually explained what they are. So I'm not going to take credit for this. This is a snippet from techtarget.com. A TED Talk is a video created from a presentation at the main TED Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference, or one of its many satellite events around the world. TED Talks are limited to a maximum length of 18 minutes, but may be on any topic. The TEDx website's explanation of criteria: TED looks for engaging, charismatic speakers whose talks expose new ideas that are supported by concrete evidence and are relevant to a broad international audience.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why we talk about them, is because we want to get more people thinking about things outside their normal realm. And me and Kent like to watch them, and they're almost always entertaining. Some of them have been have drug on a little bit. The reason we have to mention this week, last week my video was Scott Dinsmore talking about ways to embrace the life that you want as opposed to the life that you're in. Little did I know that 2 days prior to our podcast last week, Scott Dinsmore passed away. He was climbing Mount Kilimanjaro with his wife. They had taken a vacation from his entrepreneurial life to go travel the world with his wife. A rock slide happened, and he passed away 2 days before we recorded. And I wanted to take the time to state that his works are going to continue enhancing people's lives. And it's one of those things where, had I known that he had passed away prior to the episode, I probably would have, you know, done it anyway. But the fact that I enjoyed the video so much, only to find out that there won't be any more. But I wanted to take a second to thank Scott Dinsmore, his legacy, and the people that worked with him for putting out such great such a great message that I think me and Kent really resonated with you know, this podcast and things that we're trying to do with our post-military life. And I figured it is worth it to spit that out there. So to Scott, we appreciate it.
Yep.
Now that we've had the sombering moment, Steve, where can people keep track of what you're doing? Websites, Twitter, all that kind of stuff. We've already admitted that we don't like Facebook.
I have a blog that I occasionally go to, and it's Steve Perry. Let's see, what is it? The Man Who Never Missed .blogspot.com, which is I used to post fairly frequently, and then I got lazy. And there I go every so often. I go in and put something. Lately, it's been a lot of stuff about ukuleles because that's my current hobby horse, and I ride that one pretty heavy. But every once in a while, I'll put something up about writing. I have a martial arts page that you can link to for there for the martial art I take, which is I'll say the name aloud. It sounds like something you should have with peanut sauce, but it's Pupalong Pinchak Salat Sara Plink. It's an Indonesian art based basically on the blade, knives and you know, stuff like that.
Very cool.
I have a Twitter thing, but I don't post on Twitter. I just have it. Someone said you should get on Twitter, and I did, and I looked at it, and I thought, no. But so I have a Twitter account, and then I have a Facebook account, and I have my book people told me that I should have a Facebook page, which was for my fans. So I have a fan page for Facebook people. And gosh, if I can remember the name of it, but it's on there. It's Steve Perry, the writer, you know, not the rock star.
Yeah, and we'll have links to all this stuff in the show notes and on our website, witchwillmisery.com. So we'll have links to everything, every way that we can get people to find your works and to have interaction with you and talk about some of the great stuff that you brought up during this podcast. So.
Yeah, we didn't even go into the e-books. Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's a teaser for the next time you come on. So there you go.
Yeah, definitely. E-books, the transition from paper to electronics.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Yes. There we go.
Absolutely.
Quick affiliate spot. We do, if you would like to support the show, you can hop over to ritualmisery.com and click either the Amazon link, the iTunes link, or anything on the support page. We actually earned, now get this, calm down. We earned $6.48 this month from people using our Amazon link. So thank you very much for that. That's 2 months of web hosting and making this show possible. That's what that is right there. So people say that the little stuff doesn't count, but that's two more months that we can have this show going without having to come out of our own pocket. So thank you very much for that. All right. Kent, how can people follow you and listen to see what you're up to besides this podcast?
Well, if you're a beer aficionado like I am, you can go to ratebeer.com and look up username Del Noche, and you can see all of my beer reviews there.
And they can learn how to properly pronounce
Palana.
Palana. Okay, yeah. Beer. Sure, yeah. See, these are the things that you'll learn by hopping onto his little thing.
Exactly. Or you can go to Twitter and you can follow me at @rm_Del Noche. And you know, I'm always posting weird stuff there. So check me out. Where are you at, Amos?
You know, the Twitter, I'm on there. This last week I haven't been so much, but usually I'm on there pretty good. At Ethan Kane. And we still need to get to the whole names thing, but whatever.
That'll future episode.
I'm working on, I've been talking about OLCC, the O Lounge Comedy Cast, and I've been telling people that we've been doing the improv thing here locally, and the leader of the improv group, him and I just made a YouTube channel. We're going to start getting the videos uploaded, and he's going to do some super cuts and actually get some of those published out as soon as I have time to upload the videos to begin with, so you can start doing the editing. But that's coming, so I want to make sure people are aware of that. It's such a good time. If you are in Osan, if you're here in South Korea and you're anywhere near Osan on a Sunday night, come on out. It is such a blast. It's about an hour, hour and a half show, and we really have a lot of fun, a lot of audience interaction. And I think this week I might actually perform because I think we're a little low on players. So I have to get out.
The well has gone dry.
Well, we have a lot of people leaving in the next couple months, and we have some new guys that are in that I'm not sure if they're fully ready to go up or not. And I'm not saying that I am. I'm just saying that I've got a lot of practice. So there's that. I might actually have to get out from behind the computer and not just do the sound thing this week. So maybe look forward to that. I'm only a little bit nervous. I've never actually done a live show, so... as long as we don't do puns, I suck at puns. Oh my goodness, I suck at puns.
Unless you're naming a podcast episode title.
Yeah, well, even then I suck. I just work really, really hard on it. So there's that. You can always follow the show on Twitter at Ritual Misery. If you have ideas for the show, if you want to submit questions for future guests or even past guests, I mean, we're not above trying to reach out and get some other questions answered for folks. That's ritualmisery.reddit.com. You can email us podcast@ritualmisery.com. You can even call and leave us a voicemail, 567-69-TRMPC. That's 567-698-7672. And it just occurred to me that I did not check voicemails before we started the show. So if there are any voicemails in there, I'll make sure we get them funneled to Steve and get it worked out. So there's that. And, of course, you can follow all these links. And everything else can be available on ritualmisery.com. All the links that Steve mentioned, everything else. Kevin McLeod gives us our music and lets us use it as long as we give him credit. And I think that's really awesome. So thank you for that. And thank you for listening. For Kent, for Steve, and for you, this is your Ritual Misery Podcast.
See ya.
Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.